Case number 14-1079, Gordon Brent Fierce, Petitioner v. Securities and Exchange Commission. Mr. Wells for the petitioner, Mr. Schifrin for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Marcellino and I represent the petitioner, Gordon Brent Fierce. We're asking you to vacate the Securities and Exchange Commission's disgorgement order in the second case and grant no further relief beyond the disgorgement that Mr. Fierce has already paid as a result of the final order in the first case. There are three primary reasons that you should do this. First of all, res judicata applies. There was no fraudulent concealment well before the end of the first case. And Mr. Fierce's other affirmative defenses of equitable estoppel, judicial estoppel, and waiver would also bar the claim in the second case.
Was there fraudulent concealment before the beginning of the first case?
That's debatable, Your Honor. We don't need to debate that, but we think not.
I'd like you to debate that.
So. I'll be happy to. The initial order instituting proceedings alleged that Mr. Fierce conducted an illegal distribution in that SH shares issued by Lexington Resources were delivered to him, and he then resold them through a conduit, Newport, which was one of the parties in the second case, and which was one of the associated persons of Mr. Fierce in the first case. Generob was another one of the offshore companies referred to in the first case in the OIP as the associates of Brent Fierce. The revenues sought to be disgorged in the second case of $7.5 million were part of the $13 million alleged in the OIP in the first case.
My understanding is that before the first case, he was asked if he had an ownership interest in Newport. And all he said was he had an interest, but did not admit to an ownership interest, and denied any interest at all in Jenny Robb. Am I right that he said those things and that he said them before the first case started?
In effect, yes, Your Honor, but he did admit that he controlled Newport in the first case. He referred to it as his company. He simply denied that he was the actual beneficial owner up the string, which is actually meaningless. We will, if it needs to be conceded.
Did he file a form, registration form with the SEC after the investigation started that didn't disclose all of the trades that he did for Newport and disclosed no trades whatsoever through Jenny Robb?
That's a beneficial ownership form. He contends that he did file what was required by that form. It did not require him to identify every single stock transaction that Newport conducted over that period of time. He should have filed a form for Generob as well. He did not. So the commission actually has a debatable or colorable claim that Mr. Fierce concealed the trading and the amounts traded by Newport and Generob, although he did not conceal that they were his associates, because the commission well knew that. They were in documents. In fact, when we asked that the in a motion to clarify that the commission, that the Division of Enforcement identify the associates, their response was, well, Mr. Fierce knows who they are. They're in all the documents that his company produced. So that's why we say from the outset, the commission
had... My understanding is your argument here isn't that there weren't activities that could be characterized as fraudulent concealment. Your position was limited to the question of whether fraudulent concealment can apply at all, given that they knew about it before the first proceeding ended. Is that right?
I'm not sure I heard your question, Your Honor.
Okay, sorry. That you are not fighting over whether the activities in which he engaged, his answers to questions, his filings, could be characterized as fraudulent concealment in the abstract. But instead, your position is you knew everything before the case ended, so we just can't get to fraudulent concealment at all.
We didn't say they knew everything. We believe that the commission knew enough to raise the claim under the standards applicable in most circuit courts throughout the country.
So you
for example,
said they were required to seek to amend to allege the additional claims? I mean, as I understand it, this information came to them after the proceedings were ongoing. Were they supposed to amend the OIP or whatever the relevant document is at that point?
Yes, Your Honor, but only a portion of the information came to the commission.
The res judicata applies to the extent They could have defeated it by amending. Obviously, they could have, but they're required to amend, or else res judicata is going to apply?
They are required either to amend or specifically reserve the claim, either get Mr. Pierce's agreement to reserve the claim or get the court's agreement, or at least that would start with the commission. They did the poor opposite of that.
Each violation is individual. They don't have to bring all violations together.
That's correct, Your Honor, and they chose not to do that at the outset. So what we have a problem with is their position in the second case, because at the close of the evidentiary hearing in the first case, they had not yet even argued that Mr. Pierce controlled Lexington.
Yeah.
They obtained evidence from Liechtenstein. They used that evidence to support the second claim, the $7.5 million claim pertaining to the trading in the accounts of Newport General.
What matters, the fact that you have evidence that would support both individual violations. I'm not sure I understand any legal prescription against that.
Well, once they obtain the evidence.
No, I understand, but you can have evidence that will support a second claim, which is an individual claim that you do not have to join. They have no obligation to join all individual violations of the Act. They can pursue them separately. But you can have evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
That crosses over both.
Exactly.
So merely because you use the evidence in a separate independent from a separate independent violation in support of your first one doesn't mean that you're now barred from pursuing the second. I've never seen that theory.
Well, yes, Your Honor. Once you actually make the claim, that's the problem the division has here. They did capture the evidence in time to bring the claim in the first proceeding.
Right.
They chose not to reserve the claim for a different proceeding.
Well, they, in fact, did reserve the claim.
No, they did not. They did opposite.
I mean, they did because they couldn't pursue it.
They could, Your Honor. They did.
No, they didn't. They didn't because they were barred from it.
No, they weren't barred, Your Honor. They chose to abandon the claim at the preliminary level.
But not on the merits.
Well, yes, they did, Your Honor.
Now I understand what you're arguing. That's just a matter of how we're reading the record. I hear what you're saying now. I misunderstood what you were saying.
Well, I thought they actually used the claim to establish liability in the first place.
They did, Your Honor.
Yeah, they absolutely did that.
They used it in the first
proceeding. They used the evidence to establish liability.
But that's not prohibited.
No, it's not.
I mean, that doesn't get you where you want to go on stare decisis. I mean, so what?
Well, they had the same legal...
What I'm trying to say is, so you're answering what my concerns are. You can have evidence from a lot of claims that you're going to bring later and use them in the first claim. That does not mean you cannot pursue those other claims later.
Yes, it does.
Show me the case law that says that.
Well, that's in our brief.
If the starting notion is that this enforcement agency has the authority to pursue enforcement actions one after one after one, they don't have to join them. They can take them one at a time, and that's my understanding.
Right.
And my understanding is there may be evidence with respect to those many claims that you would offer in a number of them.
Right.
My further understanding is because you use evidence in the first one that you're going to use in the second one, you're not barred from bringing the second one because the second claim is based on a different theory.
Right. Not based on a different theory.
No,
that's
I'm not talking about this case. It's a general understanding.
Oh, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
No problem with that.
Okay.
And that's why, actually, the stronger argument that we have and the one that we would actually prefer to make rather than the questionable one about whether the commission had constructive knowledge at the outset of the OIP was that they actually did raise the claim in pleadings, pleading after pleading repeatedly. They submitted the new evidence shortly after the initial hearing concluded. The hearing was real.
Evidence, not to make a claim.
Yes, they did, Your Honor. They had the claim in several pleadings. The motion.
Do you think they did assert this as a claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Wait just a minute. Please try not to talk while we're.
I'm sorry.
Please don't talk while we're interrupting. I thought I understood you to say when I questioned you a while ago that they should have amended to assert the claim. They did assert.
They did, exactly.
Well, which is it? That they should have amended to assert the claim or that they did assert
the claim? They did. That's the argument I preferred to make. I was actually asked to make the preliminary argument that we don't think is as strong as the argument that we make in our brief.
Well, just to clarify, are you saying, when you say they asserted it, Are you talking about they tried to put it in and then the ALJ said no?
They didn't just try to put it in. They did put it in. The preliminary...
And then the ALJ said, I won't take those additional claims.
Yes. Yes, the ALJ said, I'll take the evidence and I'll use it to find that Mr. Pierce controlled all of these entities, including Lexington.
That's not impermissible.
No problem with that.
The direct, or did not allow, the ALJ did not allow the direct claim based on that part of the transaction framework.
In effect, Your Honor, the ALJ said, I can't handle this $7.5 million claim, although I'm going to use all the evidence supporting it,
right,
because the commission hasn't delegated to me the authority to handle this claim
in this
instance.
To allow an amendment of the OIP.
Beg pardon?
To allow an amendment of the OIP.
Exactly. So the division had at its behest tools that it should know better than anybody in the form of the rules that allowed it to move to amend. It actually cited a sort of an appellate rule, 452, to submit the evidence, a rule that's used at the commission level rather than the ALJ level. And it had rule 410, which says you better appeal within 21 days or that order by the ALJ is going to become final. And so Mr. Pierce...
I just wanted to back up on one thing in response to some questions from Judge Edwards, and that is you said they could bring one claim at a time. I suppose in a civil proceeding, they could have, in civil litigation in regular federal court, they could bring one action for one sale and another action the next day for another sale. But if they choose in federal court to come in and group all of these sales together and treat them as a common violation or common basis for a collective basis for violation, a collection of activities for which they're asserting liability. Say they said we're going to do every sale from 2000 to 2002, but then left out three from December 2002. Complete that litigation. Could they then say, well, we get to bring those three we left out from December 2002? Because we could bring one at a time anyhow, so now we're fine to bring those. Would they or would res judicata prevent that?
They could make that argument. That would be one of the closer cases. But here they...
Would res judicata prevent that?
I'm not sure.
On the three additional claims?
I don't know why.
In most courts it would. And I would suggest that in this court it would, under the case appropriately named Capitol Hill Group, mm-hmm, out of the circuit. Certainly that would be the hard test that would be applied to bar the claim.
But why are you conceding that they could have brought all of these one at a time? Because they made a decision up front to group them. That's what we're going to litigate. And so I thought your res judicata argument is that's fine, then you got to get everything that's within that group, and we have to decide whether the second case claims were within that group.
Well, because people are allowed to reserve claims if they do so explicitly.
Not reserving. Just did they? I think under Judge Edwards' hypothetical, they wouldn't have to reserve. They could just bring a lawsuit one day on one claim and another lawsuit another day on another claim.
Well, theoretically, they could do that, and res judicata might not apply. For example, if the parties were not the same, if the claims did not derive from the common nucleus of operative fact, if there were different facts and different legal theories supporting different claims, if a new statute generated a new remedy after the first set of claims, they could come back. We've discussed those exceptions in our brief. Unfortunately for the commission, that's not the case. They chose to make the claim in their proceeding. In effect, picture the commission as a district.
They didn't get to make the claim in their proceeding.
But they did, Your Honor. They made it, and they had
he or she, I've forgotten who the ALJ was, couldn't handle that claim. Is that not the one we're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor, but that's a subordinate. That's not the commission. That's the commission's task manager, if you will. Picture the commission as a federal district court with peculiar expertise in securities law. They know all the nooks and crannies of securities law. So cases go to that district judge because she knows the nooks and crannies of securities law. That district judge says, well, I think I'll have a special master to weed out all the facts and handle all these legal arguments and save me a lot of time. And then some party takes the special master, makes a claim before the special master, submits evidence before the special master, then says, wait a second, special master, I've got more evidence and I've got another claim. And the special master says, I'll take your evidence, but, you know, for that that new claim, you better go to the federal district judge because I don't have the authority.
Then you're saying that would work a preclusion of that claim?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because if not, look at the other side of the equation. Mr. Pierce was following the rules in the litigation channel he was forced to handle. He was stuck in the commission's litigation channel.
No, he wasn't following the rules because he didn't give them all the information they needed.
Well, but they got it anyway. So assuming he didn't, that's a fair assumption, they got the information in time, and they chose to use it then, which then induced Mr. Pierce not to appeal.
Well, but the then was pretty late in the process.
It was too late to pursue. If I'm an enforcement prosecutor, it's not doing me any good to get the information that late to build my case on the second case. It may help my first case, but you wouldn't want that either if you were the prosecutor. You wouldn't want to start on your second claim that late in the game?
Well, Your Honor, it didn't bother them a bit. They have good resources.
If it bothered you opposed even having it come in at all, and then now you want to argue to us that they should have brought it in.
That's right, Your Honor, because we followed the rules. We said, hey, this is sort of, we're being blindsided. They said, well, that's okay. Things work sort of in reverse in the commission's proceedings. You have a factual hearing, and then you have ample post-hearing briefs. And this claim was made in a motion after the hearing way before the post-hearing briefs were filed. So the division submitted the $7.5 million claim, exactly the same claim, same facts, same legal arguments as were brought in the second case, where they even used collateral estoppel. And then they argued again in their post-hearing briefs that they should get an extra $7.5 million in disgorgement. The ALJ only disgorged $2.1 million, not $9.6 million. Mr. Pierce looked at the rules and he said, you know, these are rules just like the federal court has rules and we better follow them. But, you know, if we appeal the $2.1 million disgorgement award and all the complaints we have about getting the evidence out of Liechtenstein, they might actually cross appeal and they might get an additional $7.5 million. Because after all, they're before the commission hasn't even ruled yet. And so Mr. Pierce said, I better play by the rules, and I'm going to sacrifice my appeal rights so that I can get finality. And he then paid the judgment resulting from the final order. The division had the same obligation to follow the rules and appeal the amount of the disgorgement order. If they thought $2.1 million was not sufficient remediation to serve the public interest, then they were the ones charged with knowledge, and they certainly have the expertise, and they certainly know the rules, and they could have appealed within 20 days, in which case then they would have signaled to Mr. Pierce, you better cross-appeal, or we're going to get $9.6 million out of this. And then he would have cross-appealed, and he said, maybe not. Maybe you'll get zero. And you know what? Maybe there would have been a settlement for $2 million. What's really unfair about this is that by following the commission's rules, Mr. Pierce is being punished because the commission has been allowed to use the seven
rules as including not providing all the information that the commission needs?
At the outset?
Right.
Right.
At the time he didn't provide it. You're saying he followed the rules. That's
Once we got at that point, yes, Your Honor.
At which point at the beginning?
I'm not going to argue that he did everything he should have done from the outset.
Okay.
He had records in Liechtenstein, so they got those records.
Eventually.
And so the commission was able to bring the claim. Now the question becomes, should the commission follow rules that it enforces in the public interest itself, or should we have a government agency that can create its own rules, not play by its own rules, and exploit people who actually do follow the rules? And it's not like they didn't get their pound of flesh from Mr. Pierce. They got $2.1 million in disgorgement from him by raising the $7.5 million claim, and now they want to use it a second time and take another, well, now it's up to $11 million with all the interest, prejudgment
interest
running.
I think we've got your argument. We'll hear from the SEC now. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Ben Schifrin for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I think the rule that we're talking about here is res judicata, and I think the reason res judicata doesn't apply here, there are two reasons, which the Court was just talking about. One is that the causes of action in the two proceedings aren't the same, and that two, even if the causes of action could be considered the same, the fraudulent concealment exception would prevent the application of res judicata here.
Can I ask you to clarify one thing? When, on denying reconsideration, JA-880, the commission said, disavowed reliance on any flexible administrative rules of res judicata, and said its ruling is entirely consistent with the application of res judicata in the federal courts. Given that the application of res judicata in the federal courts was not itself particularly consistent, what did they mean by that? Did they mean federal court cases applying res judicata to agency proceedings, or general civil litigation, or general restatement rules of res judicata? I'm just not sure what that means.
I think that was in response to Pierce's argument that the commission was somehow acting differently because this was an administrative proceeding. It was applying the rules of res judicata differently because this was an administrative proceeding, and the commission was saying that, in its opinion, that's not what it was doing. And I think its opinion makes that clear, but I think it just wanted to be especially clear in response to Pierce's argument in his motion for reconsideration.
Just doing the broad general rule, it's grounding its decision in broad general principles of res judicata.
Right, as announced by the federal courts in cases arising from judicial proceedings.
It's kind of surprising to me the commission could help itself right out of cases like this by saying, look, we looked at our statute, we're interpreting it, and for these types of administrative hearings, we need a little more flexibility. You know, they're investigatory. Things are ongoing. It can be, things can change quickly. We need to have some flexibility. And barring someone arguing that that violates the statute or the Constitution, they would have that, and we wouldn't have to sit here trying to figure out what's in the common nucleus of operative facts and what's out in this case.
Right. Well, I think the commission did, in its opinion, point out that some courts have said it can apply more flexibility.
But it didn't claim to be doing that as a matter of its authority under the statutes at issue.
Except for one instance, I think that once it invoked the federal court cases to show that the causes of action weren't the same, and invoked the federal court cases to show that even if the causes of action were the same, the fraudulent concealment exception would apply, it said that one of the reasons the division didn't have to move to amend was because, unlike in district court here, the law judge didn't have the authority to grant a motion to amend the OIP, unlike a district court judge would obviously.
Did they say that in the motion for reconsideration?
No.
Right, so that's the problem. I think the problem is the motion for reconsideration seems to turn its back on any reliance on uniqueness of the administrative process, unique needs of the SEC's investigatory process, and throw itself into the mess that is res judicata law in the federal courts.
I don't think the commission was turning its back. I think it was, as it did in its opinion, saying, look, you don't need to rely on some inflexible administrative res judicata. You can just use the regular federal court cases. But Pierce's argument was that the commission had somehow heavily relied on that, and that simply wasn't the case.
And then you keep saying it's a different cause of action, but my understanding of general principles of res judicata in federal courts is that if you have out of the same accident, same incident, I've got a breach of contract and a tort claim and maybe some statutory claim under the UCC or something as well, but it's all from the same period of incident, this month when things went haywire, you've got to bring those three causes of action together. Is that right?
I think that is right, Your Honor.
So how does it help to say that these are different causes of action?
Because here, the facts are different. The trades at issue in the first proceeding were trades in a personal account in June 2004. The trades at issue here were trades that...
But to be clear, you had to... The reason you used, at least as to Newport, you had to show volumes of sales and some control to get them out of the exemption and to get them into, I think I could have it backwards, maybe the Section 13 requirement. You needed volumes of sales. So you actually used Newport, and you had to use it, or at least you seemingly had to use it. The ALJ relied on that as a basis for finding the violation in the first case. So you already had sort of the corporate responsibility established in the first case. That's why your whole second case was largely collateral estoppel.
I'm not sure that's exactly right, Your Honor. I think that, you know, number one, the cause of action in the first OIP was just based on the trading in the personal account and, as you mentioned, the failure to report. Then additional evidence that was previously fraudulently concealed comes to light, showing that Pierce was the beneficial owner of Newport and Generob. And I agree that the law judge in the first proceeding used the evidence that Pierce was the beneficial owner of Newport and Generob, this is, I think, JA-166-67, for purposes of the reporting violation. For purposes of the control with respect to the Section 5 violation at issue in the first proceeding, I think she says you could establish control just by Pierce's relationship with Atkins, Lexington CEO, so it wasn't necessary. She then said, yes, it's a further factor. But I think the point is that the evidence that Pierce was the beneficial owner of Newport isn't the same as the trading that was subsequently conducted through Newport and Generob. That's actually two different pieces of evidence.
Is it accurate to say that the ALJ in the first proceeding said, I can't allow the amendment of the charge? Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Could you not have taken that up with the full commission, with the commission thereafter?
The division could have. I think the question is whether it had to, and I don't think it did.
The question I asked is whether it could have. The answer is yes to that, right?
Yes, of course it could have.
And that sounds a bit like what the presiding judge is positing, that if you have more than one claim arising out of the same nexus of operative fact in federal court, I think we would say that you have to bring all of them that you've got in order to keep from being barred by claim preclusion or what we used to call race judicata.
Right. Well, first, I think one of the reasons the commission didn't go down that route in asking the commission to amend, as was alluded to earlier, is that Pierce had opposed the inclusion of the trading out of the corporate accounts in the first proceeding. You can see that at JA 148 in the law judge's order. And so I think it was reasonable for the commission to say, okay, well, let's do this in a separate proceeding.
Really? No, that can't be right. You can't get got a race judicata just because somebody didn't want to let you amend your complaint to add that contract
claim? The strange thing is is it routine that the commission, I said stare decisis before, I meant race judicata, that the commission really wants to take this on as the operative notion in enforcement actions? It's very strange. In fact, I thought there's some case law to suggest the contrary. That is, that race judicata, as we would apply it, is not applicable to the commission in its own proceedings? You're taking on a very heavy burden, and I think my colleagues are right. If the commission's taking its burden on, it's an uphill climb.
I'm not sure that's true for the reasons you were alluding to earlier, that here there are two different causes of action, which
You can get away with that within the context of the administrative framework, I think, and say this is the way we do business. The question is, have you imposed on yourselves a higher responsibility? And my colleagues are absolutely right. If you really mean to, my view is that I'm surprised that you would take this on, but if you really have taken on the federal notion of res judicata, you have a lot of problems here unless you're right on fraudulent concealment.
Well, I think that just taking that on, the commission said the reason you wouldn't have to amend is because you would have two separate causes of action, even under the federal principles.
That's not true. That's what we're trying to say to you. Under the federal principles, no, unless the fraudulent concealment somehow comes into play.
But I think under the Greenberg case, the Proctor case, the Bernstein case that we cited in our brief, that would be true. Greenberg involved, very similar to here, transactions brought in one proceeding and very similar transactions brought in a second proceeding. And there the court said, those were different transactions.
No, but I think the difficulty with that, as I was trying to telegraph to your friend, is that that's some Second Circuit law on res judicata. And there's plenty of other law from other jurisdictions and the restatement, which I think is what D.C. follows, that doesn't have as strict a test as the Second Circuit applied in Greenberg. That was it wasn't res judicata if it was common nucleus of operative facts. It was, was it something you absolutely had to have that you were required to prove in the prior proceeding, which is a much more strict view of res judicata. And that's why I began by saying what was the commission throwing itself into when it made that sentence and that statement in denying reconsideration?
Well, I think that the Second Circuit, the Second Circuit also applies to the restatement test. It was simply applying the restatement test.
The restatement doesn't require that it be a required element of, you know, that you can bring as many claims in a row as you want as long as one wasn't a required element of the other. That's like a double jeopardy analysis. That res judicata is much more broader than that.
Right. Exactly. I think it has, what the restatement says, that it has to be the same transaction or series of transactions.
Right, and you chose to bundle, the commission chose to bundle all this up together and say we're going to grab all these years and we're going to look, this time period, it wasn't a year, we're going to grab this time period and we're going to look at what trading he did, and within that we are going to establish such things as his corporate, his control over this corporate entity. We need to do that to establish these claims. And then when you get to the second case, there's nothing left to prove other than the fact that the sales happened, because everything else is collateral estoppel. I think that kind of proves that it was a common nucleus of operative facts.
Well, had the commission alleged in the first OIP that all of the trading violated Section 5, that Pierce was responsible for all the trades, and that the shares and that the trades were unregistered, I would agree with you, but that's not what the first OIP alleges. The first OIP in paragraph 16, this is a JA-40, only alleges that Pierce engaged in the sale of 300,000 shares.
No, I understand that. The question is whether you were obliged, just like if someone just alleged the contract violation and not the tort. The question is whether you were obliged to do them both. As long as you are in the process of proving his control over Newport and Jenny Robb as part of proving that case, and these sales, my understanding, were all going on at the same time. They weren't. He wasn't differentiating. He was just selling stock, some personal, some from the corporate account. There was no differentiation in whom he approached, the tactics he used, and he was selling them both at the same time in that same time period.
Right. I mean, I think you're right that the question is whether they had to bring it all at the same time, but I think the answer is no under the cases that we cited in our
brief. How does fraudulent concealment weigh in your argument?
Well, so fraudulent concealment, you get to fraudulent concealment if you disagree, if you think
I know.
That,
well, let's assume that we might.
Right. So then fraudulent concealment comes into play because the reason, even if the commission had an obligation to bring it all together, the reason that it didn't is because Pierce fraudulently concealed the trades in the corporate accounts at the time the first proceeding was instituted, and so the commission really couldn't bring it. If you consider it as one cause of action, the commission couldn't bring its entire cause of action at the time the first proceeding was instituted. This court in the
when does it matter for? I'm sorry, but when does it matter? When do we measure fraudulent concealment? Do we look at the beginning of the case? Do we look at the end of discovery or end of the fact hearing or end of the proceeding? Because I think his argument is long before you filed your post-hearing briefs in this case, there was no fraudulent concealment. It was done. It was revealed.
Right.
And so I think the question of when we have to look for fraudulent concealment is very important to you.
I agree, Your Honor. And that's why the commission, in its opinion, in our brief, we cited the one example I could find of a fraudulent concealment case where the concealment was discovered before the end of the first proceeding. That was the Ally case from California. And there they said there's no obligation to amend. And they also analogized, just as the commission did, the cases where you have additional misconduct that occurs after the beginning of the first proceeding, but is also discovered before the end of the first
proceeding.
But that
was the only case you found? Because, again, I guess we have the question of when the commission said we're throwing ourselves into the arms of general federal res judicata, did they also throw themselves into the arms of general fraudulent concealment law? And if so, really, there's just one case?
Yeah, that was the only case I could mm-hmm. find. I mean, Pierce certainly doesn't cite any case holding the opposite. I don't think he cites many cases on that point at all. But even if that's the only case dealing with fraudulent concealment being discovered, I think the analogy is apt to cases where additional misconduct occurs after the first proceeding is instituted,
well,
but is discovered.
Not, maybe analogous in some sense, but it's not the same thing. Additional misconduct occurring, it's difficult to say that even arises out of the same nucleus of operative fact when it's after the litigation has started. So you only have the one case that really deals with fraudulent concealment, the facts, true facts of which are discovered after the litigation is initiated. Is that's the bottom line on that, right?
That's true, but I think the reason the commission analogizes to those cases is because the idea would be the same, the rationale would be the same. That is to say, in First Jersey, the case dealing with additional misconduct occurring after the first proceeding, it says, you know, the agency shouldn't have an obligation to amend its complaint after it learns about the additional misconduct or at risk the bar of res judicata. And I think the same thing should be true here where the evidence has been fraudulently concealed. I mean, there's no question, I don't think, under the law of fraudulent concealment, that had the concealment not been discovered until after the end of the first proceeding, the exception would apply. And I don't think it makes sense to say that just because the division was diligent and discovered the concealment before the end of the first proceeding, that it's in a worse position.
And how do you answer the argument that your friend made about this type of sort of tag team strategy by the SEC really being unfair to the people, to the defendants in the case who come in, they say, look, here's what they're coming after me on, they're seeking $2 million, they got this time period, they know about Newport, they know about Johnny Robb, and this is what they're seeking for this time period. I make decisions based on how I can test, what I can test, in this case, whether I appeal, it says, I make all these decisions. And then, lo and behold, once I'm done with that, I write my check, I think I'm done, you go, by the way, we've got a whole lot more coming. How does the commission deal with that unfairness argument?
Well, I think that gets back to the res judicata question, because it's only unfair if res judicata would bar the second proceeding. Nothing prevented Pierce from appealing the first proceeding, and in fact, the times for appealing ran concurrently, so he couldn't have relied on
it. You would say, rather than relying on it, he threw the dice.
Yeah, I think that's right, Your Honor. I think that's exactly right.
The thing that most perplexes me is why doesn't the commission in this situation have an obligation to say we're reserving?
The idea of reserving is just an exception, one of the exceptions to res judicata. And here the commission said, look, you don't need an exception because the causes of action aren't the same.
You're throwing the dice, in other words.
Yeah, I mean,
it could have, but I don't think it has.
The causes of action aren't the same, doesn't work.
You see, it's a notice. There's a kind of a notice problem here. If the commission says, this stuff came in late, we're going to use some of the evidence because it's relevant here, but we're not going to try this case. We're reserving it. That is clear notice. And I think you avoid the res judicata problems fairly, using a standard that seems to me perfectly reasonable for an administrative agency to use in an enforcement context. It's good and clean. I don't see how you could possibly lose that here. It seems to me you created problems for yourselves. What's the problem? We're reserving. You're trying to have your cake and eat it too, depending on how you look at this record. Let's see if we can sneak it by. And then, okay, we didn't, so let's pursue it later.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why don't you reserve? Why wasn't there an obligation to reserve?
I don't think there was an obligation to reserve.
Why? Because
there was no res judicata, because the causes of action weren't the same and there was fraudulent concealment.
All right. Then we come back to whether you've taken on a burden that's larger than you should have taken on with res judicata.
Okay.
Or you're relying completely on fraudulent concealment.
Right.
I mean, I think that's what the commission did. It said, first, the causes of action aren't the same. It said, second, even if they are, this fraudulent concealment. It did, though, say, look, it's an administrative proceeding. One of the reasons you wouldn't have to move to amend is because it's an administrative proceeding.
They didn't say that,
though. Right.
Oh, I think the commission did say that. I think the commission said that's where it said the idea of res judicata applying more flexibly comes into play.
But then it disavowed that. We're stuck with the final agency decision, and it disavowed any reliance on you would be on much firmer ground. We'd have a whole different case if we were analyzing this as a matter of an administrative conception of res judicata. But I read it, and I thought that's what your answer was to me in my first question, is that they disavowed it and just said, we're going with federal court res judicata.
I don't think that statement disavows part of the commission opinion. I think it was responding to Pierce's argument that all it was doing was relying on some flexible notion of res judicata. And I believe the commission is saying, no, we weren't only relying on that. We were certainly relying on principles articulated in judicial proceedings.
Okay. If we were confused about what that meant, then I suppose we could ask the SEC to clarify.
Well, but I think if you just look at what the commission, I don't think you need to, because I think if you look at what the commission said in its opinion, and when you look at it said in the motion for in the order denying reconsideration, it's entirely consistent that it was relying on the judicial cases dealing with judicial proceedings, and that really is the heart of the SEC's opinion.
It's relying on one strand of res judicata law. That's difficult in federal courts. Not all courts follow as strict a test as the Second Circuit does. That's the difficulty for you.
No, I understand what you're saying. I just think that the Second Circuit's test isn't that different from the other courts. I don't think it's that different than the Seventh Circuit, the Bernstein case that we cited. And to the extent that the D.C. Circuit relies on the restatement, I don't think it's different because the Second Circuit, if you look back at all the lineage of the cases from Proctor to Greenberg to First Jersey, they all go back to an NLRB, I think the United Technologies, where the Second Circuit adopts the restatement test.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Wells, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The problem the Commission has is that unlike all the cases it cites, in this case, the Commission actually made the claim. In the second case, the operative facts are identical. The legal theories are identical on the $7.5 million claim. Even under their best case, they mentioned Wiley, but they really discussed Allied Signal along with that. And as we showed in our briefs, in Allied Signal, the test under the reasoning there was whether a claim was actually made in a supplemental pleading after the first case had begun, like a motion to amend or motion to supplement the pleadings. The division did precisely that. They made a claim. They put it in pleadings. They then argued the very same law and the very same facts with the chutzpah to use collateral estoppel as a basis for liability in the second case, and now contend that there really is no res judicata. Pardon, Your Honor?
That did take some chutzpah. On the fraudulent concealment after the initiation of litigation, your friend at the other table can come up with only one case in support of his proposition. Do you have any in support of your proposition?
Well, there are so many in the brief, I could hardly begin, Your Honor.
Well, begin with one. The case where the discovery happens after the litigation has been initiated, there has not been an amendment made, is there a case that says that fraudulent concealment exception cannot apply to the res judicata?
The one that comes to mind first, Your Honor, is Empollo, where the federal district court did not grant a motion for leave to amend to add some claims that were related to the claims already
sorry,
in process.
Maybe I didn't hear right.
Empollo, I believe it's a Ninth Circuit case, M-P-O-Y-O. I believe we cited it in both our initial brief and the reply brief.
Okay. I was thinking it was E-M-P when you said that. Got it.
So it's somewhat analogous to this case, although it's a much this case is an even stronger case to apply res judicata, but in Empollo, the Ninth Circuit said when the claims were brought again in a second case, that is the claims that the plaintiff sought to amend by motion in the first case, and in the first case those claims were denied by the federal district court judge. I think he said you're too late, you're past the deadline. That sounds familiar here, doesn't it?
Well, wait, where's the fraudulent concealment component?
Well, and Pollo said I would have known about these claims, but the evidence was buried and hard to find. And so
they actually have fraudulent concealment.
Fraudulent concealment.
They're finding fraudulent concealment.
Do you have a case dealing with fraudulent concealment?
But it can't
be
fraudulent.
Do you have a case with the words fraudulent concealment in it that says that if it is discovered during the litigation, the party is obligated to assert it, amend to assert it, or else be barred by res judicata?
Probably not, Your Honor,
okay.
Because the fraudulent concealment doctrine actually applies post-judgment.
I'm aware of that, counsel. Mm-hmm.
But
and
the
what
commission.
What I'm asking you for is if you had a case where somebody came back and tried to make a second, or tried a second litigation and was told, even though fraudulent concealment continued until after the initiation of the first litigation, you're still barred by res judicata if you don't amend or do something to bring it forward.
No, Your Honor, because no one has conceived that there could be fraudulent concealment of a claim that is actually asserted in pleadings in the first case.
That's a different question than perhaps what I asked you. But
right. Well, so the answer was
you got the direct answer that no, you don't have a case. And that's better than a lot of lawyers do. So.
No, my initial answer was no, and I'm explaining why. Because if you actually look at the fraudulent concealment doctrine, it applies post-judgment.
We're all aware of that. Right. We're assuming that the fraudulent concealment doctrine, that the doctrine is exactly that. The point of issue, as I understand it, is where fraudulent concealment has occurred, but the information has come to the plaintiff or claimant during the first litigation, does that fraudulent concealment exception still apply to prevent the preclusion by res judicata?
I can't say that I've seen those exact words used in those cases, Your Honor.
Thank you. Any more questions? No. The case is submitted. Thank you.